This is Africa News Tonight on the Voice of America.
Hello, welcome to VOA Africa. Thank you for joining us. I'm Nabil Biagio sitting in for Yahia Zuhib, and here's what's coming up.
Classified as emergency, and many of the people now with a projected fourth rain failure are really projected to fall into famine.
That's Dawood Jiran, country director of Mercy Corps in Somalia, speaking about the hunger crisis there. This and more coming up on African News Tonight.
And we are truly, truly grateful. And I want to say to the people of Kenya and to those who have made effort to get us here that we will not let you down. We will work hard and we will not let you down.
That was William Ruto, whose election as Kenya's president was upheld today by the country's Supreme Court. The judges unanimously dismissed the claims by Raila Odinga, the main petitioner, that the election was rigged in favor of Ruto. The court found that the August 9th election followed the constitution and the electoral law with no significant irregularities or illegalities. Reporter Ruben Chama has been following the developments. I spoke with him a short time ago from Kenya.
The verdict today by the Supreme Court has been received with a mixed reaction across the country. Of course, the ruling, as expected, sparked celebrations among Ruto supporters who cheered in jubilation. And as we speak right now, celebrations are still going on, especially in his hometown of Eldoret, and also in other parts of the country where he commands a huge majority of supporters. Also, elsewhere, especially in Odinga's areas, his supporters expressed disappointment, but many of them also said that they respect the verdict of the Supreme Court.
Yes, this is an important point, because Raila Odinga says while he respects the decision, he vehemently disagrees with it. And there had been expectations of resistance or even probably rejection of the ruling. Do you see any sign of that?
As you know, many Kenyans have been expecting this verdict to pass so that they can carry on with their life. And as of now, I can say there is calm around the country, even though there is a section of people, especially from the Odinga side, who feel they have lost. But of course, many Kenyans say that they are relieved to see an end to the political stalemate so that business can pick up. Also, the fact that both President-elect William Ruto and the former Prime Minister Raila Odinga have been urging their supporters to sort of remain calm and also respect the court decision, that has also been respected across the country. And as we speak right now, for example, I've been to the city center of Nairobi and everything is normal. Things have remained calm and we do not expect to see anything different away from that.
So it's been largely peaceful. What should we expect to happen next, especially when Odinga says he strongly disagrees with the court's decision? Is this case settled or does Mr. Odinga have other legal recourse?
As of now, the Supreme Court is the highest court of the land and their ruling is final. So I think this brings to an end the political drama that has been happening over the last few weeks. And then in the next few days, we'll be seeing the swearing in of the new president-elect William Ruto. And as I said earlier, many Kenyans say that they would be relieved to see an end to the political statement so that they can go back to their normal businesses. So definitely it has been a long-awaited move to see the end of this political drama. And next week, when we see the swearing-in of President-elect William Ruto, definitely that will bring to an end the political stalemate of this election.
That was Ruben Chama in Nairobi. William Ruto becomes Kenya's fifth head of state since the country gained independence from Britain in 1964. The head of the United Democratic Alliance Party and current deputy president has served a member of parliament and in several cabinet postings. His career has not been without controversy. The International Criminal Court accused him of stirring up violence in the contested 2007 elections, which left more than 1,200 dead and displaced more than 6,000. The case failed as the court and critics said the government was serving in impeded the collection of evidence and interfered with witnesses. As Ruto's political career flourished, so did his intellectual pursuits. In 2018, he earned a PhD in plant ecology. His thesis was the influence of human activity on riverside ecosystems. In his campaign, he touted himself as a self-made man and promised to break the power of long-ruling dynastic elites that led the country for decades. He appealed to Kenya's young underemployed strivers born into poverty, or hustlers, as he called them. Ruto is expected to be sworn in on Tuesday, September the 13th. As you just heard, the Kenyan Supreme Court has rejected appeals to last month's presidential election and said that Deputy President William Ruto is the country's president-elect. Ruto said afterward, "He will extend a hand of brotherhood to all my competitors and their supporters." His leading rival, Raila Odinga, said on Twitter, "We respect the opinion of the court, although we vehemently disagree with their decision today." A short time ago, my colleague Esther Githu Ewart spoke with Kenyan constitutional lawyer Charles Kanjama about the ruling.
This is going to be the second presidential transition after Kenya got a new constitution in the year 2010. The first was from President Mwai Kibaki to Uhuru Kenyatta in 2013, and this also came after a contested presidential election in which Raila Odinga, who emerged second, went to the Supreme Court and challenged the victory. The Supreme Court disagreed with his petition and Uhuru Kenyatta was sworn in. So this is the second time in which we're having a presidential transition, again after a contested election declaration. One of the most important questions that observers were waiting to see what the court would say was on the split between the election commissioners, because a majority of the election commissioners, four of them, had disagreed with their chairman who read the declaration that William Ruto was the president-elect. So what was interesting was that the court noted that the chair of the commission does not have dictatorial powers. He has to act or work with the other commissioners. But nonetheless, they also noted that the seven commissioners worked together until the tail end of the process, and they did not find any cogent evidence to challenge the declaration of results. So what happened is you had a unanimous and very resounding verdict in favor of the Elections Commission. All 8 points, issues for determination that had been raised in the seven petitions that were being considered jointly were all dismissed. And the court therefore found that William Ruto was validly elected and was properly declared president-elect. This means that in the next 8 days, on Tuesday next week, 13th of September, William Ruto will be sworn into office and take office as the fifth president of the Republic of Kenya.
So even with the disagreement with what has happened, this case is closed, right?
So all the parties had indicated before that they'll respect the court's outcome. in our constitutional dispensation, the court, the Supreme Court, which is the apex court in Kenya, its decisions are final. So the parties have affirmed that they accept in that sense, they respect the court's decision that it has brought to an end the election period in Kenya. And those who are not happy with the court's decision, they say they're exercising their democratic right to have a free opinion on whether to agree or disagree the decision, but they are upholding the fact that the court has the last word constitutionally.
That was Charles Kanjama, a constitutional lawyer in Kenya. He was speaking with Esther Gituert with VOA's Africa 54 TV news program. The United Nations said today parts of Somalia, the Baidoa and Bornakaba districts in the Bay region will likely be hit by famine between October and December as a drought worsens and global food prices continue to rise. The Horn of Africa is experiencing its worst drought in 40 years. Experts say the region is on track for a fifth straight failed rainy season. Dawood Jiran, country director of Mercy Corps in Somalia, tells VOA's Carol Van Dam the country's Bay region has seen the worst of the drought.
A lot of the people in those areas have already moved to IDP camps. They have lost their livelihoods. And for quite a while now, people in those two areas, in particular Baidoa and Bornakaba districts, alongside many other districts in southwest states, were really in emergency phase of the acute food insecurity classification, something that is classified as emergency. And many of the people now, with a projected fourth rain failure, are really projected to fall into famine soon.
What are you seeing in the worst hit areas? And can you just describe for us the condition of the people that you and humanitarian workers have seen when you come across these people when they come into your camps and service areas?
A lot of the people, majority, I can say, over half of those 7.1 million people who are affected by the ongoing drought really fall in category of crisis and emergency. And this is slowly progressing into bordering famine in the near future. So I can say between 4 and 5 million of those 7.1 million are already in a really severe phase of the drought situation. And if you really look on the ground, and you'll find many of those families have already lost the little livelihoods that they relied on. And whether it is agriculture, with three consecutive rain failures recently, and a projected fourth and fifth, and also livestock. And you'll find, you know, a lot of these families composed of big numbers, five people, six people, sometimes 10 people. And with the loss of livelihoods, many of these people are now trekking to urban centers, IDP camps, in urban settlements or urban centers where they are seeking support. Their conditions, their body and health conditions is really very dire. You know, they have lost weight and many of them relied on the little they could get over months. You'll find children who are malnourished, mothers, lactating mothers, pregnant women are even more worse affected by the drought. So it is really a site which really you cannot look at.
How many people would you say right now in Somalia are starving?
You know, the figures are really being collected. But what you will find is many of the people affected, majority, are not able to get two or three square meals a day. So in remote places where aid agencies cannot assess, we are still finding people who are in poor health conditions are coming to the IDP camps. So I will say majority, half of the people who are now, who have come to IDP camps, really are reliant on a food aid or support from international agencies, which barely give them sufficient food.
That was Dawood Jiran, country director of Mercy Corps in Somalia. He was speaking to my colleague, Carol Van Dam from Mogadishu. You're listening to African News Tonight. I'm Nabil Biagio in Washington. Record-breaking rains have flooded the capital of Senegal. Earlier today, my colleague Kate Bowen-Dawson spoke with journalist Alpha Diallo from Dakar.
Dakar started, recording very heavy torrential rains since the 15th of last month, August, to be precise. And until now, almost every day or every 2 days, there's a heavy downpour, which resulted, to very severe flooding that has caused widespread damage.
How bad is the damage? And also, have there been casualties? Has there been loss of life?
The damage is very extensive. If you look at most of these, suburbs in Dakar, bridges have fallen. There are also some buildings that have already fell down, and some bridges have also collapsed. But many homes have completely flattened by the heavy rains. And some people right now, they have no homes. A lot of them have been evacuated, and they are currently sheltering in schools and other government warehouses. But we also have, there's also some, casualties, because just about the last 2 days here in Dakar, about 5 people were killed.
What is being done to help people? Is the government providing aid? Are nonprofit organizations working to help people?
Well, the government, the only thing that the government is doing is trying to bring in, motor pumps. They are bringing in very big motor pumps that can, pump very, very big, capacities of water every day. But some of the people I visited in schools, until now, they have not received any aid from the government. The only aid they received is from the municipality, who brought in, rice, oil, condiments, beddings, and they also brought in disinfectant to fight the mosquitoes and other waterborne diseases. But the government is only trying to bring in more pumping machines in different localities so that the water could be pumped and pumped to the various streams. People were very angry. People are saying that the government has spent a lot of money, huge sums of money, to fight the floods, but until now, nothing or little has been done. But then, Dakar, this is the heaviest rains. This year's rain is the heaviest in Dakar, according to meteorological officials, who said that since 1958, what Dakar recorded in rain, this is the heaviest rain Dakar ever got since 1958.
That was Alpha Diallo reporting from Dakar. He spoke with VOA's Kate Bowen-Dawson.
During this leadership campaign, I campaigned as a Conservative, and I will govern as a Conservative. And my friends, we need to show that we will deliver over the next 2 years. I will deliver a bold plan to cut taxes and grow our economy. I will deliver on the energy crisis, dealing with people's energy bills.
That was Liz Truss speaking today, just after she was named the new leader of Britain's Conservative Party and the country's prime minister, replacing Boris Johnson. For more on Truss and British politics, I spoke earlier with VOA's Henry Ridgewell in London.
Good to be with you, Bill.
Tell us a little bit about Liz Truss and her political background.
She's a politician who's come full circle, really. Her political career began at Oxford University when she was actually a member of the Student Liberal Democrats, one of the opposition parties. She spoke then in her student days of her anti-monarchist views. She supported the legalization of cannabis. But during her time at Oxford, she switched colors. She became a member of the Conservative Party then, and she slowly worked her way up the ranks through David Cameron's government and more recently Boris Johnson's government, serving as Trade Minister and most recently as Foreign Secretary, with the role that she has fulfilled until today, and indeed until tomorrow, when Boris Johnson officially steps down and Liz Truss will take the keys to number 10 Downing Street and become Prime Minister.
Quite a turnaround from her early Liberal positions. What about her foreign policy? What do we know about that?
Yes, so we've had a good window on her thinking on foreign policy, given that she served as Foreign Secretary under Boris Johnson. And what we can gather is that really she will continue many of the policies that Boris Johnson instigated, but perhaps in an even more forceful and hawkish manner. Many of those who know her say that she has more of an appetite for risk than Boris Johnson. So, for example, she was at the forefront of Britain's decision to arm Ukraine very early in the lead-up to Russia's invasion of that country, and has been steadfast behind that policy since then. And on the campaign trail over the summer here in Britain, she's spoken of the need to continue that support well into the future, to continue to provide weapons to Ukraine and to continue to provide money to rebuild the country, and to continue to take a very hawkish stance against Russia geopolitically as well. So we can expect a continuation and indeed an intensification of Britain's support for Ukraine further down the line. She's also been very hawkish on China, perhaps more so than Boris Johnson. She was involved in Britain's decision to ban the Chinese telecoms firm Huawei from the rollout of 5G mobile technology in Britain. That was a sore point from, yes, Beijing's perspective. So she's expected to be far more hawkish against China as well.
China. And here's another one. Has she had much to say about Britain's relationship with Africa in the past?
As Trade Minister, she was involved deeply in the Brexit process. She actually supported remaining in the European Union, but then changed her mind after the vote. And during that role, she spoke extensively on her hopes of building trade relations across Africa. She spoke of the fact that 90% of GDP growth, as she put it, was outside the European Union, much of it in Africa, and wants to further build trade relations there. She said that Britain currently has 43% of the African continent covered by trade deals, and she wants to expand that. On another note, your listeners will be aware of Britain's policy of trying to send failed asylum seekers, or indeed all asylum seekers, tens of thousands of them every year, to Rwanda for processing there.
She's been a big
advocate of that policy,
yes,
and she wants to extend that to other countries on the African continent as well.
That was my colleague Henry Ridgewell in London. Chad's military government yesterday lifted its siege on the opposition Transformers Party. The French news agency AFP says police and the army had surrounded the party's headquarters and home of party leader Success Marser in the capital in N'Djamena on Thursday. Authorities say 12 of their officers were injured when a protest became violent. Police say at least 84 activists were arrested for holding an unauthorized demonstration and disturbing public order. But the party says nearly three times the number were apprehended. Chad's Minister of Public Security said last night that the activists would be returning home today. The Transformers Party is part of the Wakitama coalition, made up of the opposition and civil society organizations. The group, which does not enjoy the support of two of the country's more powerful rebel movements, has refused to take part in ongoing negotiations to return the country to civilian rule. The military took power in April 2021 and says it aims to hold free and democratic elections within 18 months. I'm Nabil Biagio. That's our show for tonight. For more news, please check our voaafrica.com and voanews.com. On behalf of producer Nadia Taha and engineer Joe Gill, thanks for listening. Have a good evening.